In 1940, a child born in America was almost guaranteed to make more money than its parents. But by 1980, it was just a 50-50 chance. So what happened? And how can parents these days help their children succeed? Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us on Skype. Welcome back, Derek.
Good to be here. Thank you.
What about that stat that a child's opportunity to earn more than its parents is far less than it used to be? What's behind that?
I think that stat in many ways is like the skeleton key in terms of understanding the decline of the American dream. The American dream is many, many things to many, many different people. But one thing that it is to many people is the expectation that our children should do better than their parents. That, as you said, was practically guaranteed in the middle of the 20th century. And now it's basically a coin flip. And in many parts of the U.S., it's actually worse than a coin flip. There are many parts of the U.S., especially in the Southeast, rural areas where children are trapped in poverty for generations and generations. That's not what the story that this country tells itself. That's not the story that America tells itself. And so I'm very interested in not only how we reclaim the American dream, but also how we make it a universal phenomenon rather than a spiky one.
And that's why you spoke to Harvard economist Raj Chetty about this for your podcast, Plain English. His team found that whether you can achieve part of the American dream, this part, that a new generation will be better off than the previous one, can depend on where you live. What's behind that?
Yes, neighborhoods in many ways tend to drive outcomes. And the trillion-dollar question here is, what are the specific ingredients of neighborhoods that turn out to be so successful at churning people from the lower middle class into the upper middle or even upper class? And as Ross Chetty told me on my podcast, you know, he has been working for a decade to understand this. And there's a couple of things that I think clearly stand out. One thing is that segregation turns out to be terrible, not only for, say, Black Americans, non-white Americans, but also we tend to see that places that are segregated have worse outcomes for just about everyone. That's a really interesting fact because it tends to show that there's a kind of solidarity dividend. This is Heather McGee's term, a solidarity dividend that is shared by a society that doesn't try to cut people out from the American dream, that seeks opportunity for everybody. This is a really important thing, I think, for neighborhoods to understand.
So neighborhoods are essential. Friendship is also a key part of upward mobility. Chetty's research shows that when kids in lower income families interact with kids from families with a higher income, they have a better chance of upward mobility. How does that work?
I think this is absolutely fascinating. It's so important, this idea that economic interconnectedness, friendships across classes, seem to be a really, really special ingredient in terms of ensuring that a neighborhood is promising for the American dream. But one thing that Chetty found that's alarming and really important is this thing that he calls friending bias. That's the idea that even if people from different classes are living close to each other, for a variety of reasons, they don't necessarily become friends. This is important to figure out because it's not just enough, you might say, to build more housing in middle-class areas to ensure that lower-income people can move there. You also need to overcome this friending bias that people have, where they tend to become friends with people who are similar to them economically, whereas we find that the opposite, friendships across classes are really important in terms of prolonging the American dream.
College is considered a key to upward mobility, but a lot of elite schools, including Harvard and MIT, tend to favor students from higher income backgrounds. Most kids at these schools come from the top 1%, the bottom 60%. What role do colleges play in widening the wealth gap?
And this is absolutely critical, and this is one of the most important things I think that Chetty has found in his research. You know, we tend to think of America's best colleges, its elite institutions like the Ivy League and its flagship state universities like the University of Virginia or the University of Michigan. We tend to think of these kind of schools as engines of social mobility, but instead they're not. They're more like life preservers for class distinction. At the most prestigious schools in America, a child from the richest 1% is 77 times more likely to attend that school than a child from a family in the poorest quintile. I mean, that is just astonishing. These colleges clearly have incredible outcomes for high-income students and low-income students, but they don't seem to admit very many low-income students at all. And that says something, I think, quite depressing about the state of elite education in America. The story, again, that these colleges are telling themselves is at such odds with the actual story of the students they're admitting into their classes.
Okay, briefly, some solutions. So ending on a good point.
Sure, that's another good point. All of these things are policy decisions. We can change our policies. We can make neighborhoods more inclusive. We can end housing segregation. We can accept more low-income students into America's most prestigious institutions. We can do all of this. But again, the outcomes are downstream of our policies and our choices.
Dark Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, thanks so much.
Thank you.